Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
The world of work has changed dramatically, and organizations are evolving. A full or part-time MBA from UCD Smurfit School equips managers to react at pace and deliver change. Now is the time to transform your career and gain a new business network. Join our virtual MBA Experience Day on Saturday, November 20th. Register at smurfitschool.ie/events. UCD Michael Smurfit Graduate Business School. Developing impactful business leaders.
Welcome everybody to the Blood and Mud podcast. We're here, we're still going. We are the podcast that makes remote working an art form, let me tell you.
Oh, well, I mean, some podcasts right now are struggling because they can't be in the same room as each other. Me and thee, fucking easy street.
I had to go on a work call thing and we were using Microsoft Teams. And of course, me not really thinking, I put my podcast headphones on and my pod mic.
Yeah.
Because why wouldn't you?
Wouldn't you?
Of course, it goes on Microsoft Teams and somebody goes, whoa, you've got some Top Gear there. So I don't mess around me. I don't mess around me. Then somebody says, you look like DLT. I said, I fucking hope not. I don't behave like him.
All the people you can get. I mean, to be fair, comparing you to any DJ from the, you know,
yeah,
the golden era of Radio 1 and 2 is fucking, it's, let's be honest, it's an absolute minefield at the moment.
Blackburn,
all right?
The what, sorry?
It's Tony Blackburn.
Yeah, but he ain't got a beard, has he? My mum's really funny. My mum was, you know, the whole, that horrendous, you know, yew tree stuff?
Yeah.
And my mum lived through the 70s and 80s, obviously, as a kind of teenager and woman working. And she says, the way she kind of qualified the different levels of it, she went, see, the thing is, she said, DLT, right? He was just, they were everywhere. He was just a 70s groper. And he had to put up with him every bloody workplace you worked in. I was like, she was like equating that obviously he wasn't as bad as all the others. I mean, the fact, I said, Mum, come on now. Surely he's the other side of the line, isn't he? Well, I suppose she's lived through it, so she gets to make these decisions.
Yeah. Still, I'd rather just have no gropers.
Well, like quite. Yeah, it was wrong then. It's wrong now, Mum. Come on. right then, I am Lee, and over there is Josh.
Josh, yes, I am.
A bearded Josh. He's gone.
Yeah.
He's gone full caveman.
I'm going to go full Dave Lee Travis with this. I'm going to see if I can have a beard that just goes all the way around my head like he did.
Yeah. Was it they call him on the Chart Music podcast like a living Nasher badge?
That's incredible.
So in between trying to plan the continuation of the delivery of my part of the health and social care system, Josh, I'm doing DIY. That's quite a lockdown, isn't it? What have you been up to?
At least you've got, I mean, I kind of wish I had fucking DIY to do, to be honest with you, mate. I'm just a bit bored now.
Is your marriage on the rocks yet?
No, it's all right. Yeah. I mean, give it a couple of weeks.
Mine's all right. We're both consumed with work and DIY, exactly. So we're all right.
Exactly. It's good to have something, you know. I've power washed the back patio twice now, consecutive weeks. First time it needed it. second time I have something to do. And it's fun to...
Well, you are working though, aren't you? You are working all
the time. Yeah, yeah, I'm working in the week. But, you know, it's
Them weekends is long, aren't they?
Them weekends is long. And also, it's sort of like, well, I've done everything. You know, what can I... I've completed the house, if I'm honest, from a sort of, you know, I've got a few doors left to do. I kind of wish... If this had happened last summer, I tell thee, this house would be absolutely pristine. Right?
Well, you'd run out of energy. I like it.
Yeah, yeah, nah. Sitting, that's what I'm into.
So we're doing, like, loads of work, then DIY, then we're, like, putting about 10 minutes of MasterChef on and falling asleep on the sofa. It's a recipe for a successful lockdown marriage, let me tell you.
Yeah, I mean... Yeah,
don't have enough energy to fall out with each other. That's the way forward.
That's absolutely the way to go, yeah.
So, if you want to get in touch with us and tell us how your lockdown's going, I'm Lee at bloodandmud.com or at bloodandmud on Twitter. And what about you, Josh?
At Josh Gardner on the twits.
Are you not writing on Rugby Shirt Watch?
I can't be fucking bothered with that right now.
The less you do, the less you want to do.
It really is, actually. I've totally gone off a cliff with it this year, having quite gone off a cliff with it last year. And now nobody's doing anything anyway because it's fucking the world is in lockdown and no sport will be played until fucking God knows when. So why would anybody release anything new?
Indeed. So we're on Acast, on iTunes, we're on your whatever device you've got right now.
Yeah, quite literally, whatever you're listening to right now, we're probably on it.
We're also on Patreon.com. Thank you for everybody who gives us their support. The VIP lounge is open, not like the other pubs. Ooh. The virtual pub, the virtual lounge is open. Come on in. I'd like to welcome in this week Camilo Lemos.
Ooh.
Yeah, who's actually given more than the minimum door cover charge required.
Good Lord.
Because he's such a good man. Well done to you. We've got new stats on Acast telling us the gender split of who listens to us.
Uh-huh.
And I'd like to say a big hello to the 8% of our listeners who are women.
Hey, guys.
Which I don't think is doing too bad. I think that's actually pretty good female listenership compared to some others.
I'm kind of, like, compared to some of the specialist interest titles that I've worked on in my life, that's actually a pretty good split.
Mm.
Like,
yeah,
I've worked on things that have like 1% women, which I mean is not. It's fucking horrible, isn't it?
Boy,
but yeah,
stuff,
I'll take that. 8%, I will.
I'm telling you.
Yeah,
we welcome you. We welcome everybody, of course. But it was. This is a new stat this week, so I was quite interested when I saw it. Now then, we start as we always start with the player spotted.
Yes.
Sam Marsh DMs. He says, I've got a couple of players spotted for you. A couple. Two in one email. That's some high efficiency. He says, 2018, England versus Pakistan test match at Headingley. Stuart Lancaster was sitting three rows behind me in the Western Terrace. He seemed like a decent guy. Says Sam. Well, I think everyone knows that. Play. I'm interested to know what about him from three rows away gave him away as a nice guy. Was he pleasant with people? Was he buying a round of drinks? Was he just generally looking at ease with himself and life? I think all of those things when it comes to Stuart Lancaster, all of those things.
Yeah. I think he always seems like a really nice bloke. Even, you know, it's his worst moments, he always carried himself with dignity, which is more than you can say for a lot of those guys.
Imagine what it would be like being... If you're at home with Stu and you're being homeschooled, I bet he's got endlessly practical things to do in this lockdown, Stu Lancaster.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, he's watching a lot of film, I would imagine.
A lot of game film.
Yeah.
He'll have lots of activities set out for his kids to do.
I mean, he was always going to be in real trouble with this because he still lives in Leeds, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And he gets a plane to Dublin every day to go and work with Leinster, which is...
Every day? He must have a crash pad in Dublin.
Well, apparently, all I know is that the reason that he didn't take the Ospreys head coach job a couple of years ago when it was offered to him was that there were no daily flights between Leeds and Swansea Airport.
I mean, it's a trunk route. You'd be surprising there isn't. I mean, Swansea Leeds is a trunk route, isn't it?
There are no flights to Swansea from anywhere.
My son went to the Leeds Festival last year, and there was a direct train on the Sunday between Leeds and Ellesmere Port, which is a little town on the Wirral. It was very bizarre. Yeah. I thought, this must be a festival special. There cannot be a direct train between Leeds and Ellesmere Port, ordinarily. That cannot be a thing.
Well, I stayed in a hotel in Ellesmere Port once.
Oh, which one? Was it the Holiday Inn down by the boat museum?
Yes, down by the boat museum.
Yes.
And then I went to a wedding the next day, and they didn't have a headphone to red and white phono connector for the iPod to the sound system so that they could play their playlist. And because I was an usher, I had to go to Argos in the middle of Ellesmere Port on a Saturday morning to try and get this. And I'll tell you what, it was experience.
That's in the Port Arcades, Argos in Ellesmere Port.
You're correct.
I work in Ellesmere Port. Well, when I'm in work, I'm in Ellesmere Port. I genuinely love Ellesmere Port. It reminds me of my childhood. Being surrounded by those people, and it gives me great comfort. However, it has got a big, massive sign in lights. It tells you how good the air quality is on a day-to-day basis because it's got Stanlow Oil Refinery and loads of other stuff around it. It's quite industrial. But without these places, all these tossers who live in leafy places wouldn't be able to live the life you live, would we? And drive the fucking Range Rovers round. So, do you know what I mean? So give respect.
I mean, I'll give it the respect that I agree with you. It made me...
Not you, Josh. I'm talking to people out there. I know you'll give respect to Ellesmere Port. Don't you worry.
It also reminded me of my childhood in the sense that it reminded me of the past.
It reminded me of a place you wanted to escape.
It reminded me of Aberdeen in the late 90s, early 2000s. And and to be honest with you, Aberdeen today.
Yes. But we're not quite sure what it is just yet. Yes.
But Ellesmere Port, to its credit, had many more open shops than Aberdeen did. So, you know.
So there, Stuart Lancaster at the cricket. And then also 2016, Sam says, I saw Ross Ford on a flight from Bristol to Edinburgh. I thought I had some big signing scoop, but alas, no. He disappeared off the plane before I could say hi to him, says Sam.
And there we are.
And there we go, the two player spotted. Send your player spotted in to Lee at bloodandmud.com, or you can do it on the DMs, or, you know, whichever way you want, or the Patreon messaging, if you're that way inclined, if you're one of those lovely supporters of ours. Now then.
Some news. I've actually got some breaking news
that's literally happened as we've
been on air, and it's quite serious. USA Rugby has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy as a result of coronavirus.
Does that include MLR as well?
I would imagine so. It's everything.
Oh, shit.
Everything. Yeah, basically, rugby in America is going to go bank. Well, Chapter 11 is, and I know about this from my other job, Chapter 11 is basically bankruptcy protection. So you basically get you file for Chapter 11, it stops your creditors from basically calling in all your debts and putting you out of business, but within 30 days you have to basically have a plan to cut costs and get yourself out of it. And this says in this, the Rugby Board and Congress agree that filing Chapter 11 supported by a robust action plan is the optimal strategy in these exceptional circumstances. The current suspension of sanctioned rugby activities caused by the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic has accelerated the existing financial challenges facing the union, and a reorganisation process will now be progressed with input from World Rugby. It says significant cost reductions in the financial support package from World Rugby will allow the board, Congress and governance restructuring to continue under union operation and control. So,
well, that's immediate cessation of Matthew Bastrow's chocolate rations, I imagine.
Big style, like straight up, that's going to be fucking huge for MLR and all of those players that it's currently playing.
I mean, obviously, there are bigger, more tragic things going on in the midst of all this, but that is a shame. It did feel like it was just getting a toehold, but also it does demonstrate to you that they were properly, literally, 2.5 weeks away from bankruptcy at all times.
Yeah. And it comes back to the sort of rugby cannot afford itself situation, particularly in, you know, basically they're saying the suspension of the Major League Rugby competition combined with loss of revenue from spring and summer membership dues, sponsorship drawbacks, and additional revenue sources. Basically, it's every, as is, and you know, if you're trying to sell any kind of advertising at the moment, which, you know, again, my other job, nobody's buying, nobody's selling. People are just trying to fucking stay in business. And yeah, it's shit. That's, I mean, particularly given how much effort and time and like hope has been placed in America.
Oh.
Like,
America always lets you down eventually.
Yeah.
You play.
from a rugby point of view, like, betting on America is always the fucking golden goose. But yeah, this is bad and big if this happens. But Chapter 11 is not full bankruptcy, so.
So maybe, yeah, maybe they'll have a plan just to tick over until this all comes back. We'll see.
Basically, yeah.
Right, the other news, Ireland's tour of Australia is doubtful. They're not confirming it's off yet, but it's doubtful. Everything is doubtful, so it will be off, so just accept that. In other news, Jackson Rae has announced he's to stay at Saracens after their relegation, which we assume is going to happen still, even though the season won't complete.
This is the thing, isn't it? Talking about anything in the future, it's just like, all right, yeah, well, I'm sure Jackson Rae is prepared to commit himself to having a paycheck after this season.
I'm not sure it's even that. I think he's just too much of a shithouse, like, even for like Steve Diamond to sign Jackson Rae. Everybody looks at him and went, no, you know what? No, don't fancy it.
The same reason that England has never really gone this. No. Fucking hell, I don't even just know. He's a really good player, but fucking hell.
Don't like his face. Don't like, just, it's not good. So there you go. So that was the news. Any more news? Anything else going on?
Only thing I would like to sort of say is get well soon to a friend of the pod, our first ever guest, Lenny Woodard, who's got the corona but is on the mend by all accounts.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, all the way. He won't listen. Lenny's far too urbane and cool.
Exactly.
I followed him on Instagram and he followed me after that interview. And his entire life just seems to be going away for the weekend.
It's great, isn't it? He just seems to be constantly on old boys tours.
Yeah, or he's away with his family for the weekend in different hotels. He's just he's got some life, as Lenny. Good for him.
Yeah.
And hope for your full recovery, Len.
Indeed.
So there you go. So we said we didn't want to watch the classic game this week. I don't know why, just because... I don't know, mix it up. Got plenty of time to watch them still.
Exactly. Everyone's doing it as well.
So I thought I'd just take a great bit of joy by making Josh watch Building Jerusalem, to be honest, and I've had to rope you all in just to watch Josh's pain. Mm. Now, obviously, you've avoided it for a long time, but you couldn't avoid it any longer. How was it? How much actual physical... Did you feel actual physical pain watching it?
Firstly, let it be said, I'm absolutely not the target audience for this film by some distance. I think I'd genuinely think I'd have more fun going back and sort of critically analysing the first gig that I ever played as a 15-year-old in the Mount Pleasant in Chicanon, or having my undercarriage waxed. either of those things, probably more fun than watching this.
It's funny, it is interesting, right? Because obviously, this is a sports documentary. And we've all watched sports documentaries about teams, well, I have, about teams we don't like. And I thought that was interesting sports documentary. It is funny how a lot of Welsh people come back to you and just can't even bring themselves to watch it. Scottish as well.
Like, even the name of the film makes me want to smash myself in the face over and over again.
What, Building Jerusalem?
Ugh, God. Also, it's so English rugby, and I may be leaping ahead a little bit here, that we cannot get a minute into this fucking film without Thatcher turning up.
Oh, yeah, that is true. She does turn up in it, doesn't she?
Literally, the first thing in the credit montage is fucking Thatcher. And they're talking about the 87 World Cup. And what's Thatcher got to do with that? We're in fucking New Zealand. Ugh. First thing. Anyway.
So, we'll do this now before rather than at the end. How do you think it does stand up as a sports documentary generally? Leaving aside the fact that you wanted to smash your face most of the time.
Ironically, I think it's quite interesting until the World Cup starts.
You know what? I've written down here the first 20 to 25 minutes are the best bit of it.
Comfortably. Like, until the World Cup starts, it's genuinely interesting. because it gives in a semblance of insight into a team that won the World Cup. Once the World Cup starts, it just turns into everybody trying to, with the exception of Wilkinson, everybody interviewed trying to sort of out self-eulogize themselves.
And also about, that first 20 minutes covers the transition from amateurism, which is genuinely quite interesting. Yeah,
indeed. So it starts obviously with Wilkinson, like, talking about Johnny Wilkinson as a mildly terrifying fact that Johnny Wilkinson at the age of 8 is watching the Rugby World Cup in 1987 and had a notebook with his fucking life goals in it. When I was 8, my life goals were getting that massive Lego pirate ship and being allowed to stay up late enough to watch Red Dwarf.
He actually says, I wrote an essay to myself when I was 8.
What? Like, I mean,
because I'm a little bit of a sociopathic weirdo.
It really does indicate, this whole sort of thing shows in quite vivid and terrifying detail that Johnny Wilkinson's perfectionism was quite clearly unhealthy and damaging.
Absolutely, yeah.
On a personal side. Like, he can still remember that he spelt the word gauge wrong in a spelling test when he was a kid and he only got 19 out of 20.
And he does a sort of awkward laugh after that, which is also kind of, because he's trying to, like, oh, isn't that funny that I still remember it? But actually, you think, no, it's not funny at all,
that's
Johnny.
That's fucking sending for CBT level worrying, mate.
And I do like the fact that he's been quite open about this obsession thing. Yeah. You know, it wasn't good for his mental health and actually he couldn't enjoy it and stuff like that. But still, it's
it makes me feel for him properly, because like it's easy to take the piss out of how zen he is these days.
But wouldn't you just spend some time getting to that stage if you were
fucking
him?
Right. It's like it was the reason that he was so good, but the sacrifices in terms of his personal and mental well-being must have been so damaging. And it's like, it's probably the only thing that now enables him to function and have a nice life.
And everybody, including this documentary, everybody, and I've noted this actually, there's a massive, massive focus on Johnny Wilkinson in this documentary. Now, everybody had a massive focus on him during that up to the World Cup, called it a one-man team and all that stuff. And that was never particularly fair then or particularly accurate then either. No. And yet still, all these years later, even with the benefit of hindsight, this documentary still just focuses kind of almost solely on him and his experience and his whole life experience up to it. I mean, of course, any 10 is a fulcrum of a team, isn't he? Of course he is, or she. But it's still
weird how over the top they are with it compared to, you know, when it was clearly a team effort and you're talking to other people in the team and you still make it all about Wilkinson, to the point where he's, you know, he probably talks, you know, as probably twice as much
at
as
least
Johnson,
yeah, twice as anybody, I think. Yeah.
And it's, but yeah, as you were saying, like, A, can we talk about some quality 90s fashion on show at the start of this documentary? Mm. There's shell suits, there's dodgy knitwear, there's massive trainers. I mean, basically, he looks like he's hanging around Hoxton in 2020.
Yes.
But
it wasn't worn ironically in any way at all.
No, not at all.
And it's also the England training camp from the mid-90s when they're all in non-matching kit and just running through left to right passes, walking up at three-quarter pace up and down the pitch.
They're all in non-matching kit, but all of that kit says Cellnet on it.
Yeah, and there's the point, isn't it? You know, we'll come to that in a minute about payment, because it becomes a thing. Magnificent use of Don't Let Me Down, Gently by the Wonder Stuff.
Yeah.
Who'd have thought that was good? Straight out of Thatcher. A very weird intro altogether, basically.
I mean, flipping to the end, then there's the Libertines, isn't there,
at the end
of it?
Yes, Don't Look Back, or whatever it's called, is it? I can't remember.
Yeah, Into the Sun, whatever it's called, which I think was released after 2003. I'll just check that.
Yeah, I think it was.
The world of work has changed dramatically, and organizations are evolving. A full or part-time MBA from UCD Smurfit School equips managers to react at pace and deliver change. Now is the time to transform your career and gain a new business network. Join our virtual MBA Experience Day on Saturday, November 20th. Register at smurfitschool.ie/events. UCD Michael Smurfit Graduate Business School. Developing impactful business leaders.
Acast recommends Podcasts we love.
Changemakers is a new podcast series with me, Claire McKenna, talking to people who stand up, speak out, or challenge us to think a little differently.
It's about the greater good, families and children, respecting their own individuality.
In the next couple of years, like, I hope I never have to have conversations about racism ever again. Like, I just want to get to the stage where, you know, people are just people.
Nobody's pooling the resources together and actually being able to show how much of an impact it will make when people do come together.
Changemakers with Claire McKenna. Search for it now wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast is home to the world's best podcasts, including the David McWilliams podcast, I'm Grandmam, and the one you're listening to right now.
Don't look back into the suns. It would have been around about then. 2000, wasn't that until 2000? Oh, no, yeah. Yeah, 2003. Yeah, so bang in the...
All right, I would have thought it was that early.
Yep. So, I would have thought
it was late as well. Yeah. Well, like Johnny Wilkinson walks in at the beginning and comes and sits down in a darkened interview room, and he's absolutely wearing a perfectly on-brand sort of shirt from the what looks like it's from the Burton's Big and Tall range.
Absolutely,
to fit his neck, but then it fits nowhere else.
Yeah. It's very true. And Martin Johnson looks like he's turned up to go to court.
Yeah.
Like full suit jacket, tie, blazer, cuff. Like, I feel like he's wearing his old school tie in the hope that that gets him off. And then Clive just dressed like Clive, obviously.
But you're less than five, apart from in the flip chart scene, which I'll come to in a bit. But you're less than 5 minutes in before he mentions the terms mental anguish.
Yeah. Yeah,
less than 5 minutes. See, like, ooh, I thought this was a fucking joyful celebration of a win. Five minutes, man. He's like a rugby Jon Snow. You know, when that he sort of said, "Hey, Johnny, Johnny, what do you think about going wide a bit more in this game?" Don't talk to me about playing wide. How could I think about playing wide? You haven't. Well, I've seen the darkness that awaits us all. I've seen the dead walking.
To shoot way ahead to. To when to right at the end where he's saying that, like, the sort of the moment that he wishes that, like, he could live in forever is the moment between Mike Cat, the ball basically leaving Mike Cat's foot to boot it out at the end of the extra time and the referee blowing his whistle. And that's the moment that he wishes, because and he doesn't say it. But you can hear it sort of unspoken in it, that he's sort of thinking, once I've won the World Cup, then there's nothing else left for me to do. And then I will be sad because I've achieved everything in my life that I wanted to. And so he just
wants... I've seen the Army of the Dead. I don't want that ball to go out because the Army of the Dead are coming.
But it's like, it's that he wants to live in that moment between when he knows that he has achieved his goal, but that
it isn't over.
He's got nothing after it. He's got nothing left in his life. Once he knows that once he lifts that World Cup, it's all over. Nothing left.
I'm laughing almost in disbelief, to be honest, because I can't imagine what that must be like. But I genuinely believe that is what it's like. You know, 100%. Of course, I believe him. It must have been awful.
A deeply damaged, certainly during his rugby career, an unbelievably damaged and dysfunctional human being who. Used that, you know, the bits where they're talking about, and again, I'm going to jump here again because we're just fucking talking about the bits where what's his face he gets with the Newcastle trainer bloke,
Steve Black,
and Steve Black basically just sort of goes, "Oh, this guy's got some sort of obsessive compulsive disorder. Brilliant. This will mean that I can feed." And Wilkins is like, "Yeah, he could tell that I was, you know, really dedicated," and he fed off that. And it's like, no, he could tell that you were. Dangerously obsessive compulsive and went, well, this means that this guy's going to be a psychotically good trainer, and did it. And he's like this, putting the thing in Wilkinson's head about having like a sort of 24-hour mental CCTV. Imagine CCTV is watching you 24 hours a day.
Yeah, the 24-hour mirror, or what's it called, 24-hour camera.
Yeah.
No matter who else is around, you get to the end of the day and you think, have I done what I'm supposed to do today? And of course, Johnny's answer would be, no, I haven't.
Yeah, no, I haven't.
I must do more.
There are tears that I haven't shed yet. I must. And things like things like he's him saying when he gets dropped in the 99 World Cup before the quarterfinal, and Neil Back puts his hand on his shoulder and says, there's a lot of this tournament left to go. And he just bursts into tears on the bus.
Oh, God.
Like, how the fuck does somebody not fucking get around him at this point and just be like, Johnny, I think you need to go and see a fucking shrink, mate.
Yes.
Immediately.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. Like, genuinely made me think, I'm really glad Johnny Wilkinson is still here. Because...
Andy and Brum watching it fed back and just said, you just want to give him a massive hug. You want to step into the screen and hug him, don't you?
He's just like, genuinely terrifying. Like, I'm not sort of casting any aspersions, but it's like to take somebody with that mentality and basically just go, yeah, fucking lean into it. Become as obsessive and like self-damaging as you want because it'll make you a brilliant player. And it did make him a brilliant player. But it's like, fuck me, that could have gone badly.
Yes. Well, it did go badly in many ways because he says he spent a long time being utterly miserable and scared, effectively.
Yeah. And it basically seemed to ruin a lot of, you know, when the injury started coming in, it ruined most of the rest of his career until he went to Toulon and fucking learned to chill out a bit.
It may as well a bit of sun will do, isn't it?
Well, indeed.
So anyway, the game starts, the documentary starts, really talk about how England had obviously been shite for years and this transition into professionalism. Jono does a brilliant bit about reflecting on, he came into the Leicester youth team as an amateur and just kind of shakes his head and laughs thinking about the things that used to happen.
And I think that's really interesting, actually, because that comment that he says about like playing top level rugby, because you know he was playing top level rugby in the amateur era, and you say you did it because you wanted to play rugby, and then you went back to work, which I think is really interesting when you, because there are still people in the game and in the game and out of it, to be honest, the still active rugby is that, you know. As opposed to a professional, you know, all the fucking rampant clubhouse bullshit and the hazing and the sexism and the violence and the bigotry and all of that stuff is just like, oh, you know, it's part of it. But in this era, the stakes were unbelievably low. It's like, oh, if you didn't like that environment, and if you found it, well, you just would stop playing rugby. And the people who were there didn't give a fuck. And like, it doesn't, how many amateur players were put off by rugby or that? But now it's a professional sport. It's like, yeah, if you want to be part of rugby, you have to be part of that culture. And also, you've got a fucking contract that says you have to stay. It's like, and it's no wonder that it causes so many more, like, obviously society's moved on, but it's no wonder that this clubhouse culture causes so many more problems now and in the professional era, because people can't just quit if they don't like the way that people are behaving and the way that, I just thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, no thought of it like that, is.
Him sort of saying it like that just made me think, oh yeah, all of a sudden there's these professional players in academies or wherever that don't have a choice but to just walk away and go to their job because they probably don't have one.
So it starts in 94 in the amateur era, and we mentioned the England camp with the non-matching kits. This is still the Will Carlin, Rob Andrew days and all that.
Mm.
And there's discussion about it, you know, there's a building momentum about it going professional, South Africa are back in, the World Cup's coming. And Dudley Wood, the chair of the RFU
God,
at that time,
he says,
what does he say? He goes, yes, money is a very corrosive influence on things. And he says that, and it's over a shot of him and all his mates having like fucking swan and chips off a fucking ivory plate at a massive fucking black tie event.
While England players fucking mug for fucking Cellnet and Tennent.
And fucking Courage Best Bitter and stuff.
Yeah.
And what does he say? He goes, we'd all like to be paid to follow our hobby, wouldn't we? And he's like, well, you're obviously getting fucking paid in food and fucking...
Honestly, it meant like, I just could not have despised anyone more than him in that moment. Where he's just like, well, these players don't need to get paid for their hobby.
But he says, you know, we're all rugby men, lucky enough to have lots of experience in running the rugby game and money.
Honestly made me just pray for Kerry Packer to just come in and smash it.
You know what? I've never wanted Murdoch unleashed on people more.
Nobody ever deserved it more than the RFU did at that moment.
And they were talking about it being fun and recreation. And Will Carden, actually, looking back on it, said a lot of sensible stuff, as much as
he fucking did, to be fair. He got verified for it, but he's fucking bagged.
What did he say? He said, you know, they say it's just it's fun and recreation, but you don't have 70,000 people turning up to watch something that's just fun and recreation. And you certainly don't have a World Cup for fun and recreation, do you? I want fucking paying, pal, basically.
It was, yeah, and... Like the sort of the sniffy sort of disdain that they're going out of, just like, oh, well, these Southern Hemisphere types are sort of doing, you know, a turning professional. And it's like, you're just thinking, yeah, fucking right they are. I hope they fucking stick it to you for the next 7 million years.
Yes.
It's like, I don't think I've ever developed such an instant disgust for somebody.
That was obviously what they were doing, the filmmakers.
Of course it was, but I think mine was more visceral than even it was intended. Ugh.
So then, of course, the World Cup happens in 95, and then it's like, look, it's going to go professional, basically. Yeah. I'd kind of forgotten it wasn't quite professional at that point, although it looked very professional.
England basically refused to go professional for a year.
And I'd completely forgotten the Packer versus Murdoch thing, where Murdoch basically bought all the unions, so then Packer bought all the players as they played out their battle over rugby league and cricket and everything else, and the fucking row over.
It's gloriously shithouse, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's so much shit.
Yeah, so you've got the tournaments, pal, but you've got no fucking players to play it up, because I've got more under contact.
And players getting fucking really narky in press conferences when they're being asked about it.
Do you see Sean Fitzpatrick's face? And he got asked, like, fucking hell. If I was that fucking journalist, I'd have pegged it. Absolutely pegged it if Sean Fitzpatrick looked at me like that. Because weirdly,
anyway,
Fitzpatrick's got quite a kindly face for a big,
has,
frightening
but
man.
When his face drops,
yes,
and he looks at you with those eyes, you just think, "Whoa,
yeah,
that's how you captained your country."
I'm sorry, Sean. Something inside me sort of fell on its side there when you looked at me like that. Yeah, so, yeah. But and even like you said, even when they decided to go pro, even then the RFU went, well, we're going to put it on hold for a year.
Yeah.
Why? Just because it's that last vestiges of that we fucking still think we run shit, which is what...
Yeah, it's blatantly... Martin Johnson sort of says at various times that things were about control.
Yes.
And people in seats in Twickenham boardrooms thinking that they could tell these players what to do, and gradually, over the course of... You know, a few years of back and forth. It's the players just going, no, 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 no.
Yes.
Until we get where we are today.
I bet you at some point Dudley Wood and his cohorts were in a room, somebody said at least five times at different times, I mean, this is like the animals taking over the zoo. I bet they said things like that, didn't they? I bet that's exactly what they said.
Yeah. The lunatics are running the asylum.
Yes, exactly, yes. So,
the
yes.
word betters was used in that boardroom so many times.
Yeah. I mean, you can't blame them. They don't really understand, do they? This is the thing. You know, is that kind of... hey, there was one interview, though, and in the background, I looked at the pitch and I suddenly thought to myself, when did that stop? Because it has stopped and I don't remember when it stopped. There was a freshly mown pitch behind, I think it was Will Carlin or Rob Andrew, behind him. And it still had the 2-inch long grass with the shorter grass on the lines.
It wasn't Twickenham. It was the old National Stadium in Cardiff. I think it was a BBC Wales reporter. And I know it's exactly the same thing. I was like, fuck me, when did they stop?
Because I remember that. And clear as day, I remember, God, they just don't do that anymore, do they? That slightly long, which is supposed to, break your fall when 10 massive men fall on you, as opposed to cut grass in the normal length.
Yeah.
I've not been down a fucking amateur clubhouse for a long time, I have to say. But I wonder if amateur clubs are still doing it.
Yeah. Let us know, please. Yeah.
So anyway, Woodward gets...
Yeah.
After the 95 World Cup, Lomu, etc., Woodward gets the job. Were you going to say something else there before you moved on to this?
I was just going to say, like, you can sum up Clive Woodward's entire galaxy-sized ego, and I will come back to this over the course of this. In the whiteboard scene that you're about to talk about, no.
If you
doubt.
Haven't seen it, ladies and gentlemen, it's a whiteboard scene, and he's got a flipboard up, and it's the title of it is Fastball.
Yeah.
And then underneath it, obviously, it's him trying to communicate something about fastball. It says technique 25%, attitude 75%.
But
flatball, not fastball, flatball. But yeah, go on.
But the best thing about that then is it then pans down and underlined, it says, underneath all of those things, it says, the key thing is the coach. That's just him in an absolute nutshell.
But it's also, why does that need to be on a flip chart? You could have just said, the thing about flat ball, lads, is you've all got the technique. It's just about the attitude. It's mostly about attitude. Let's go. But instead, it's on a flip chart so he can point at it.
75-25.
Just in case you don't understand. He also has a full fucking spam head and a massive Pringle jumper
in that fucking, particularly when he's wearing those little weird concentration camp surgeon glasses at the start, like, and with, as you say, with the full Mr. Burns, mega Dominic Cummings vibes.
Ooh, yes.
He looks like a man who loves a bit of herd immunity and game theory at that point.
Picture with him in the jumper. The
fucking jumper.
Like a proper hideous grey Pringle jumper.
That was the fucking fashion of the day. People wore that.
And he was only 40 years old at that point.
I mean, yeah, maybe chunky jumpers. Of my granddad.
Chunky jumpers were of the time, but not a Pringle one.
Yeah, maybe I'm thinking of my grandfather who played golf. So,
So Woodward gets the job. What I like about it as well, he says that he turned up on his first day and said to, I think, was it Nigel Woodward? Whoever was the fucking guy at the RFU then. He said, hello, I'm here to, I'm the England coach. And he went, what are you doing here? I said, well, where's my office? And we haven't got an office. What do you mean I haven't got an office? I said, well, I thought you'd work from home. No.
Why the fuck would I work from home?
I want a fucking office. To be fair to him, right? I mean,
that's the thing. He's a bell, but it really does emphasise that they are really starting from fucking square one with this professionalism shit. Like, there's not a lot of, they'd had coaches before. He was coaching at London Irish, you know, but
now Jack Rowell in 95, Dick Best was before that.
But it's not exactly high level, is it?
Jack Rowell, the reason why Neil Batt didn't really get a truckload of caps till he was in his mid-late 20s was Jack Rowell just didn't fancy it because he wasn't Mike Teague, basically. He wasn't that massive fucker, so.
Yeah. Also, one thing I've noticed throughout this, and you start, as soon as Woodward appears, you notice it, he always says I and never we when he's talking about coaching decisions, which it seems so weird put through the prism of, like, modern coach speak. Where it's always about the collective. It's always about the coaching team. You know, you hear Gatland talk, you hear Schmidt talk, you hear Eddie Jones talk even, who's not a man that's short of an ego.
Yeah.
It's still talking about how, you know, we, the coaching team, make the decision, or we decided to do this, or we did. It's always I with him. It's always I. And given how fated his assistants were, I wonder how they feel about the fact that he talks about it like that. It's like, I decided to do this. I decided to bring this player on. I just say, it's like, did you?
So he's a, and then the first thing they focus on is that, and I suppose they mentioned the Tour of Hell in 98. And I think it is easy to forget that it was only 5 years between that tour and winning a World Cup, which doesn't seem like a short amount of time, but I think in the life of an international team, it can't, you know, it's a short amount of time. I said, like you said, where they started from. So, of course, to get to this summit, it's just worthwhile dwelling on this a minute, only because the first team were all pretty knackered. So we had to pick, like, a shorter team to go and face. They lost 70, in case you don't remember, anybody out there, they lost 76-0 on the 6th of June 1998 in Brisbane to Australia. The England team that day, which are young people and whatever, was, fullback was Tim Stimpson. Remember him, yeah?
Yeah.
Wing, Spencer Brown. No fucking idea. Don't remember him at all. Outside centre was Matt Perry, who was a fullback for a few years.
Yeah.
Inside centre was Steve Ravenscroft, who I vaguely remember. Wing was Austin Healy.
No memory of him at all. Yeah. Johnny Wilkinson. Remember that guy. Wish I could forget, if I'm honest.
Johnny Wilkinson was at 10, obviously, and 18 years old. Scott Benton was at 9. Very little memory of him. In fact, by very, I mean none. Graham Rowntree, Richard Cockerell, Phil Vickery. Yeah, I'm on solid ground there. Danny Grucock and Gareth Archer. Yeah, solid ground with those two in the second row. Back row, Ben Sternum. A blindside.
Don't believe that. Doesn't sound like a real person.
Richard Poole Jones.
Again, open sounds side. Like
no idea.
Absolutely
no
sounds memory. Like a rugby game that hasn't got the rights to the players.
Yes,
would call an England back rower.
Captain and number 8 Tony Diprose. Yeah, remember him. And then on the bench, Stuart Potter, Ben Clark, yeah, Dominic Chapman, Alex King, Dave Sims, Duncan Bell and Phil Greening. Now, that England team, just bear that in mind, everybody, and Josh. Mm. Let me read the Australia team that they sent that team out to face, okay? In Australia.
Yeah.
Fullback, Matt Burke. Winger, yeah. Ben Tune. Centres, Dan Herbert and Tim fucking Horan. The other wing was Joe Roth. George Gregan and Stephen Larkin was the halfback pairing. And the pack was Richard Harry, Phil Kearns, Andrew Blades, Tom Bowman, John Eales, Matt Cobain, David Wilson, and Tutai Kefu. Have some of that.
I mean 76 still is probably some sort of.
I love the way it was quite cemented. It was 33-0 at half time as well. They saved it. Yeah. They spaced it out. They spaced the hiding out over the full.
Some teams will get it done by half time and then spend the second half just sort of coasting. Australia were like, nah.
Do not remove your foot from their throat at any time.
We're going to make this hurt all the way.
And George Gregan was particularly awful about it, wasn't he, as well? Well, you take your legs sometimes, you know, and everybody likes to beat England.
Yeah.
So it was after this that Lawrence Dennaio gets appointed captain, and there's a great line he's so Brent, isn't he, at times, Woodward, where he says running a rugby team is no different to a small business, because before that he had a small business with 10 people in as an offshoot from offshoot from his career in Xerox. What is it about rugby and fucking photocopying?
Copiers, mate. But can we, I think there's a sort of because Matt Dawson is in this occasionally as well.
Yes.
And he makes a very sort of interesting comment about basically at this point, Clive Woodward would literally buy any old motivational or performance enhancing shit that somebody put in front of him. I mean, that is funny.
Yes.
It's blatantly true, but it's both kind of, it makes sense. Because it's used as the management bollocks is used as a stick to beat Sir Clive with, and absolutely, that's fair enough.
Yes.
However, if you are effectively starting from square one,
and somebody gives you a load of fucking money, don't forget.
Yeah, and somebody gives you £40 million or whatever it is, or $40 million dollars they spent between fucking 1999 and 2003. But on the one hand, yeah, he bought into so much dreadful management bollocks that continues to blight the game to this day, let's be honest.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, yeah, rugby just turned pro. Nobody knew how to be professional rugby coaches or what would and wouldn't work. In modern terminology, they were looking for marginal gains, and he was just, to be fair to him, he was ahead of his time in
that. He was ahead of his time, and I think that when you are when you're first through the wall, you're going to make mistakes, aren't you? You're gonna do something like that. Looking back, that didn't make any sense, but you know, at least I made a fucking decision and gave it a go. And I do think as well, this is the late '90s. I think this is when the consultancy era really comes into its own, isn't it? So the consultancy spam he must have been being offered.
Oh, massively.
He went, yeah, I'll have some of that. But yeah, I'll have some of that.
The fact that he absolutely still believes that everything he did was brilliant when his players are openly ripping the piss out of it in the documentary about it does say a lot, mind.
Yes.
However, speaking of appointing fucking Dallaglio, am I the only one who totally forgot about his drug scandal?
Well, it isn't in the front of my mind all the time, but as soon as he said he was captain, oh yeah, I remember why he's not captain no more now. Yeah.
I totally feel like, genuinely, when you boil this shit down, right, he admitted on fucking tape to doing a load of fucking coke and ecstasy in the 90s, bragged about selling it. In the amateur era, and then admitted that he'd done drugs on the Lions tour a year earlier. And somehow, he gets a slap on the wrist, he loses the England captaincy, and gets fined $15,000, and everything's fine.
It's fine. Like,
can you fucking imagine if that had happened, if Owen Farrell admitted dealing drugs in 2020? Like, even if he was denying it, they had him on fucking tape.
What's funny
he would never get near a rugby field again.
And Clive Woodward says, I brought him in. I brought him into my house. I sat him down. I said, "What's happened?" He told me, and I believed him. Which translates as, he's my captain. I think he's brilliant, and I don't want him to fucking not play, is what that translates as. And then Delalio gives his public statement afterwards, and he's properly a bit pissed off, saying, "You know, I mean, you know, I completely deny this. I followed a line of questions that the journalists instigated, by the way."
What? So, have you ever done drugs, Lawrence? Yeah, I have.
See if you can avoid the cunning trap that Lawrence Delalio fell into, Josh, okay?
Yeah.
Right, here we go. I'm a journalist.
Yeah. Ready? I'm Lawrence Delalio in this.
Well, you be you in this. See if you could. Because Lawrence said it was tricky. And you're not as experienced as Lawrence, and as high profile. So here we go. Right, Josh. You rob banks and spend the money on illegal rhino poaching, don't you?
No.
Whoa! See, how have you managed to do that? That seems really...
He basically made out the stuff about him fucking selling it was him trying to give it the big one, which is almost more tragic than just admitting that
you are the captain of the England fucking rugby team and you're trying to give it the large one
I sold some fucking...
I'm not just a fucking rugby captain. I sold fucking loads of drugs. Took drugs. Yeah, I'm fucking mad for the drugs. I've triple dropped fucking today before I've come out, if I'm honest.
It's less fucking lame to admit it.
Yeah, in the amateur era, I fucking sold drugs to make some money. I'm very, very sorry. That would have been the better thing to say, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Instead of, I was just trying to act the big man by pretending to sell drugs.
And it's the way that Clive Woodward goes. And I looked him in the eye and he told me the truth. He's like, "No, you sat there and you went, you fucking knob, you've done this, haven't you?" And he went, "Yes, right, and let's make up some shit that will just about be plausibly deniable." That's what happened, allegedly.
Allegedly. Oh. It is funny, but it is funny that people never talk about this when arguably, like, one of the biggest, you know,
what's come up with him last week?
Oh, no.
Delalio. Where they've raided a house of ill repute in London and found that receipts of him paying money there. Although they're very clear to point out it doesn't detail what he spent the money on. Just that they've found, as part of a discovery for an unrelated case... In the court, Lawrence Delalio's name paying $10,000.
He spent up to $10,000 in a broth. I mean, drinks are very expensive there, you know. Yeah.
I deny all of this. I was just following a line of questions that the prostitute that they instigated, by the way.
Oh, it's so shit. It's so the like the reaction of somebody that has never been media trained at this point, you know?
And I kind of like that in a way.
I quite enjoyed it. It's like Lawrence just getting arsy with the journalist for having the temerity to say, "Have you ever done drugs, Lawrence?" And him going, "Yeah." And then getting arsy with the journalist for doing it.
People slag the News of the World with good reason, right? But uncovering stuff like this was funny. And also, don't forget that we would know nothing about the cricket match fixing and all that stuff without the News of the World. For all that, they did a load of shit, and I've got not a great deal of sympathy for them, but however, that kind of like really fucking awkward twat journalism does have its place.
It does. It's important because it's shining fucking light on things that people would rather you don't
and
see.
And it takes unsavoury people to do it, frankly. So, you know, and that's...
Yeah. Including like spending money from your own bank cards during a visit to a discreet Georgian townhouse in Holborn, London, which also offered clients cocaine.
We must stress that we do not know what Lawrence Delalio spent money on in there. All we know is that in a court case in discovery, we found out he spent money there. That's
payments.
It.
Payments of up to $10,000. Payments, plural.
We don't know what the payments were for, but we do know where it was spent. That's all we know. Anyway. So, 1999 World Cup happens. That skated over and how it didn't go. They lost to New Zealand, then the fucking whole losing to Gianni Urbiez drop goals and all that kind of stuff. We've actually got episodes on the 1999 World Cup, if you want to listen to it, on the Patreon, if you fancy having a look back there. It is back there. Mm. So after this, he decides to go. He spends even more money after 99. Well, he actually thought he was going to lose his job because he said before that World Cup, "Judge me on this," and then obviously it didn't go so well.
Yeah.
So he thought he was going to get a bullet, but they stuck with him. So after that, he went real fucking super Clive, didn't he? Because he then...
Well, the glasses come off.
he gets fucking laser surgery.
Yeah.
And he brings Andy Robinson in. He brings Dave Allred in. He brings Phil Larder in. Or at least that's the three he puts together. What is interesting is that there's no mention at all of Brian Ashton, who came in for 2 years between 2000 and the end of 2001, and arguably England played their best rugby ever in those 2 years. And there's no mention that he was even there.
I honestly think the things that aren't talked about in this are almost more interesting than the things that are, because there's clearly a narrative. And because, you know, like, there's all this talk about, like, all of these, you know, marginal gains things that he's doing, you know, to get England over the line. At no point do they mention one of the most important things for that 2003 England team, which is Nike developing the fucking super duper skin tight spandex kit, which when you look at them opposite everyone else, is a, and what we now know about rugby in terms of making it harder to grab onto you, making it harder to bind on you, etc., 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 fucking game changing, because now everyone does it.
I think France had the same kit, didn't they?
But France had the same kit, and South Africa had the same kit, so it can't be a sort of Sir Clive innovation. Nike innovation. So it's totally airbrushed from history. And then you see them fucking playing Wales, and it's like they're billowing fucking cotton shirts.
And you're Australia.
Like, yeah, same.
Each shirt weighs 3 stone.
It's really fucking interesting what is and isn't said. But yeah, Clive takes the glasses off. Everything starts working. Can we get reprints of those mental posters that he made?
Now, he makes posters, and we get a little snap. I kept pausing it to read what was on the poster.
I kept trying to read them. They're amazing.
It was in full early 2000s England font as well. It was all branded in like England font. And what's interesting, we mentioned Lancaster before, the lovely guy that he is. It was all the kind of shit that Lancaster eventually got pilloried for.
Yeah.
Because the epilogue to anything is written by the winner, isn't it? So because it didn't work for Lancaster, it was a symbol of how he was too focused on that bollocks. Whereas with Woodward, it's all part of his genius.
Eulogised, yeah. Yes, so he has every area of the game has its own motivational, very detailed motivational poster. There's about fucking 70 words on each of those posters.
There's a section. There's
like clear communication, is there?
There's a section called Must Lead. An entire section is called Must Lead. And a list of the things, and I'm assuming they must lead, right?
Yeah.
And this is a list of them. The first, the top of the list is you must lead rail track.
Yes. I saw that.
And I don't know what that is.
What does that mean?
Power running.
In similar vein, there's a thing that just says turnover, and then underneath it just says ice.
Oh, that's an acronym for something, and I can't remember what it is.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like teacup. That's one they kept using. Is it something under pressure? I can't remember. But anyway, in this must lead section, rail track, power running offload, contact, kicking and catching, footwork, width. How do you lead width? I'm confused.
You just run to the fucking tramline as quickly.
Follow
as
me. Like early career Johnny May. He was a leader in width. Height at lineout is another one. Guard defense and turnover. And then there's an entire section underneath, which we only see the title of, and there's not the rest of it, which is simply called adding to our armory. I don't know what was under it, but I want to know.
There is so much correlation, equaling causation thinking going on in Woodward's brain throughout this, and you can really see it. Like, some fucking businessman who's got nothing to do with rugby comes in and tells him that the players should change their shirts at halftime. That's straight out of,
that was amazing, wasn't it? Yeah.
80 City bullshit. And then, of course, he does it. The England players change their shirts at halftime, and they play well after halftime against France for a change. And all of a sudden, it works. And it was so obvious.
Yeah.
It's like, no, mate. You just happened to play better because you were wearing, like, there's two clear narratives in this, which is really interesting, I think. Whenever you hear Woodward talking, it's Woodward determined to make the World Cup win and England success down to his innovated thinking and coaching genius, and sort of the number of times that you hear him telling players to trust, you know, he says so that he told players to trust the coaching and trust the system and all this sort of stuff. And then you talk to Wilkinson and Delalio Johnson and who else is there? Fucking Dawson.
Dawson in particular is kind of, although he's probably that kind of character, he wouldn't buy into it, would he, I don't think.
No, but it's like the players putting it down to them working and training harder than everybody else, learning from so many disappointments, and then being really together as a group after that whole player strike thing, bringing them all together as a squad as a really tight knit group.
Actually, everything was like much tighter after that because it was a strike over money, wasn't it? And again, the RFU was apoplectic that people might have an opinion about.
Yeah,
How dare you bite the hand that feeds you?
And Dawson said that it was over a matter of basically like £250 for an appearance fee to when they sort of got to do. But the implication was to do with image rights, basically. Is like, if you want us to turn up to do a sponsor thing, we want £250, and that caused the England players to go on strike for a week before the Six Nations. It's like, imagine that in this day and age, it's absurd.
It's at this point as well that Woodward talks about everyone gets the England black book. Do you remember that bit?
Oh my god, that fucking black book!
It's a little black notebook with the embossed.
It was embossed with the maker's name. I was trying to figure out what it was because I desperately wanted it to be made by Filofax
or Moleskine.
No, Moleskine would be too cool. That's the thing.
That's true. Yeah, so it's embossed, and in it is all the how to conduct yourself on the pitch. And then at the second half of it is how
50% of it.
How to conduct yourself in life. I imagine Delalio said in it, "Don't brag about buying cocaine to journalists," was like the first line. We could sniff at it, but the thing is, it is some of it was patently ridiculous because it's going to be because he was just pulling the trigger on everything, wasn't it? Yeah, do that. Yeah, do. I've just been on this training course. Do that. Yeah,
I've just learned. Textbook person that goes on a training course and then comes back and says that everybody should do it that way now. Yeah,
and he's but you know, it's, and a lot of people listening will say, "What the fuck have you done? He won a World Cup," and he did. And he did genuinely change rugby. It's still faintly ridiculous looking at it now, though.
Yeah.
And it's the way the players find it faintly ridiculous as well, which makes me feel better about the way I feel about it. Yeah. So
they were there winning it, you know, arguably because of that. And they were just like, this seems like absolute bollocks, to be honest.
The things it doesn't cover is an interesting one, isn't it? Like you've already mentioned, no Brian Ashton, nothing about the shirt. There's no mention at all, which I think would have been interesting, no mention about those lost Grand Slams.
Yeah.
For 4 years, 3 years. Yeah, three, yeah. 4 years on the bounce. And how that affected them and how they... Because it was always at the end of a tournament, then you work back together again for a few months. I think it would have been really interesting to have some reflection on that. But again, probably not part of the narrative. It was all part of... But it would have been, really, because you said... Because they were still building. Because it would have been... How did you get over not quite getting over the line? Because actually they won the Grand Slam in 03. There was something about 03 that all came together, wasn't there?
Is it because it's too easy to sort of then go, well, this group of players had so many disappointments that eventually they learned to sort of overcome them and not be afraid of them. And then the flips, and that sort of diminishes the Clive is a genius narrative a little bit.
Well, and like you say, once the World Cup starts, it gets a little bit boring because all the comments, it falls back into kind of banalities like, I believed we could do it and the boys were playing well, so we just kept going and stuff like that. There's a bit of reflection on the fact they were playing poorly, because they were.
Yeah, they were.
There's nothing at all dwelling on the fact that basically it was a pissy, they got the, not piss easy, but they got the best side of the draw.
Yeah,
there's
one mention where they say they get to avoid New Zealand, but at no point do they mention that New Zealand team could very well have absolutely battered that England team when they were playing the way that they were playing.
And there's something about the Australian hoodoo which kind of puts...
If the all-form book goes out of the window at that era with Australia and New Zealand. But yeah, one point in the actual World Cup bit, though. When was the last time you heard a Welsh person say the word boyo?
Oh, yeah. I know, he's explained for people who may not have seen
because
it.
Clive seems to think that Welsh people were saying, and I quote, boyo this and boyo that and banging on the coaching box
as I walk down the tunnel. You're not going to win anything, boyo, with boyo this and boyo. It's like, who was sat behind you? Fucking Windsor Davis.
Yeah, the entire cast of Grand Slam. Fucking, it's, I mean, it's a little bit sort of revealing. That's all I'm going to say.
So when the Wales game is interesting because obviously Wales at half time, and Martin Johnson says, and in a way this is very insulting, but I actually quite liked it because he was being honest about how he saw himself and the team when he said, we were behind and all I could think of, none of these guys would even get in our team.
And he's correct, though.
And we've beaten 4 years on the bounce. Well, I don't know. I think Alfie are getting ahead of Dan Luger.
True, yeah. But that attitude is kind of what that... And that goes back to sort of talking about the squad mentality that they had, that they were so tight and they believed that they were all the best that they could get, you know? And also, Wales were quite shit at that point. Let's be honest.
And it was just, let's give it up. I mean, how can you say that Kerry Sweeney wouldn't get in ahead of Johnny Wilkinson? What the fuck is wrong with you?
Jonathan Thomas ahead of Neil Back.
What a fucking fend, though, from Sweeney for that try.
I mean, it is great, isn't it? They do a mighty job of not at any point, like, demonstrating how shit England are playing in this World Cup as well. It's like, aside from that fucking South Africa game at the start... They touch on it with the Wales quarterfinal because they have no choice.
Yeah.
But it's like Wales played them off the fucking park for like quite a lot of that game.
They talk about not having the ball against Samoa for 20 minutes, don't they? We gave the ball and didn't get it back for like 25 minutes.
Yeah. Do you want a little bit more? Nah. This was also the World Cup of gloves.
Oh, gloves with England flags on them.
Gloves with England flags on. Is there anything worse? But also in the, like, everyone's wearing fucking gloves at this point. It's mad.
Gloves.
Marginal gains.
This was the gloves and the plaster on the nose. Remember that thing?
Yeah.
It was meant to open up your airways more or something. There must have been ear, nose and throat fucking surgeons just shaking their heads watching this every week.
Yeah.
But the other thing is there's a lot of this is Woodward voiceovers that are quite clearly scripted. And let's just say he's not a very good actor.
Yeah,
the scripted bits are very, really very not. Obvious. So then I brought on Mike Catt at halftime because that seemed like a sensible thing to do, sort of thing.
it is basically that.
Yeah. The other thing is that they played very well in that France semi, right? They played very well in that. Did you notice when it was showing the team room before the France semi, the two flip charts that were on the wall?
I didn't know.
In the background, two flip charts, both headed, titled Weather.
Yeah.
And there were five bullet points on each flip chart. It was like, what is the... What? I mean, surely you could have just written, it's pissing down.
Do you know what? There's a bit in a game when they're in the team room before that game. It might be before the final, actually. When there's literally like bits of flipboard that have been ripped off a chart and stuck on a wall. And each one of them, and there's about seven of them in a line, I think it just says, like, professional mentality. Just written professional mentality, professional mentality, professional mentality. Like, seven times.
I think it was like, lines for Lawrence Dallaglio. You've done it again, Lawrence. I want seven lines. You will write professional mentality.
Not that kind of lines.
Yes, boom. and to be fair about not playing well, they played a perfect game against France, and that was the game when Wilkinson was fucking outstanding.
Yeah.
And that's when it all became about one team. I did like when he showed the Roy and HG, the Aussie comedian guys. He said, well, we've seen their two game plans. They've got a wet one and a dry one.
Yeah.
We've seen them both. Yeah.
Word of appreciation, actually, for the only good joke Clive Woodward has ever made in his life as well, which is man outside his hotel room shouting boring and him saying, well, I was in bed with my wife at the time, which
Zinger.
Genuinely very good guy.
Genuinely funny, yeah.
He absolutely thought about that a long time ago.
He wrote that down seven times. Yeah.
But still, appreciation for the only funny thing he's ever said.
The other thing as well, in the final, crowd scene in the final It pans past a bloke in full England kit and a fucking Saddam Hussein rubber mask.
It's Iraq War, mate.
I know it was the Iraq War, but I don't understand that.
When was Saddam captured? Let's timeline this. So
I don't understand if they had an effigy of Saddam Hussein like being shot, and even it'd be ridiculous, but I'd understand that. But just having a rubber mask on of Saddam Hussein doesn't make any sense.
Oh, okay, maybe because this was after he'd been deposed in April 2003, but he wasn't apprehended in his little hole in the ground until the 13th of December. So he was on the run.
Was it somebody pretending to be Saddam then?
Somebody making a gag about you've been looking for Saddam. He's in Australia watching England the Rugby World Cup final. I mean, yeah, it's not great, is it? It's
Andre average. Watson. Andre Watson, by the way, a big shout out to Andre Watson, referee in the final. I never noticed before until I watched it again. His absolute peak early 2000s sideburns.
Big star.
On a man in his 40s, like slightly balding, but perfect long to the bottom of the earlobe sideburns going on. Slightly too thin.
Yeah. He's taking a little bit too much of the edge off.
Yeah, too much of a point on him. Yeah. I do remember they were saying about how he gave him nothing in the second half. I do remember being absolutely mystified at the kind of things he was ruling on in the second half. It was very, very bizarre.
Yeah, and it's easy to forget how home and host England seemed to be at half time, and they add up, and then the wheels just.
When you watch it again now, it is honestly I actually can't watch the game again now because I get so fucking angry at how we didn't just fucking sort have it done and dusted and kept letting fucking Elton fucking Flatley keep him in the game.
He kicked beautifully. You got to give it to him.
He did kick beautifully. What's your opinion, because it divides opinion, this, it's divisive, on that Australian shirt?
I got a lot of time for that shirt.
It's unique, if nothing else, isn't it?
It's unique, and it's one of the last baggy rugby shirts. It's not properly baggy, but it's one of the last sort of old-fashioned rugby shirts before they... Because after this World Cup, everybody went super skin tight because of England and because of, you know... That whole, and it would never go back again. But that sort of era of Canterbury shirt, I've got the Ireland shirt from that era as well, is very, very nice.
It's very nice, that one, yeah. Slightly more green than it is now.
Yes.
More of a pea green to it, if you know.
Yeah. But let's not beat around the bush. Like, as moments of sporting drama go, even as somebody that has, you know, has skin in the game, and that skin is intense dislike. Wilkinson's drop goal is undeniably probably one of the most dramatic and iconic ways to end a game that in the history of sport, full stop.
Off his wrong foot.
It's a remarkable thing.
It is, as sporting drama goes, it's unbelievable, yeah.
Yeah. It's just a shame it also led to England winning a World Cup, really. But
and
you know,
Clive Lord would still been on the telly.
Yeah, forever and ever.
The epilogue,
imagine if they'd lost this game. Imagine how Sir Clive's methods would... Like, how rugby would have changed if they'd lost this game.
Mm. And then the blurb at the end, and it goes across different players about how Johnson retired, and it said Woodward left after falling out of the RFU, which is true, and it just jumps to... And then he became head of GB and culminated in the 2012 London Olympics. As if...
So
basically nothing about Southampton and that he basically delivered the London Olympics for Great Britain is basically where that jumps to.
I don't believe any of that. Because wasn't he on the Leicester Tigers board for a while?
I don't know. He played for Leicester, didn't he?
I think he was like a non-executive director or something in between after the whole Southampton debacle. And then, yeah, I mean, fair play to him. Maybe he did do good stuff at the BOA. I don't know. But everything that happened to Sir Clive after this, in the immediate aftermath, really did make me think that people got very carried, in a sort of very early 2000s way, got very carried away with unconventional thinking in the boardroom. which is kind of very peak 2000s, instead of just going, well, what did he actually do? What did he actually achieve? And what he actually achieved was bringing together a very, very talented team and galvanized them in a way that meant that when shit was going sideways, as it did in the final, they had the fortitude to stick to their plan and stick with it. And that's more all the sort of stuff that he clearly loves. All of the sort of...
And he did pull to... It's not as easy as saying those players are so good. He actually went through a few iterations of squads over the years.
Yeah, he did.
Even if you look at like 2001, 18 months out, it still wasn't that team as it was. It did develop a little bit more. So actually, and he did very actively go after Jason Robinson and say, you know, this is exactly what we fucking need. Yeah. And I know that he could say, well, of course, because he's great.
Right.
But actually, he was rugby league player. It's not easy to go and do that, you know. And
How many players did Sir Clive try to bring over that didn't pan out?
True.
But Jason Robinson was one of them.
I mean, we can laugh at it.
Absolutely stuck.
Which we have done. I think his legacy is an interesting one. I mean, the 2005 Lions, which again, we've done a Patreon episode on, we can talk about that. He shredded his own legacy there because he'd just been smelling his own farts for so long, I think, that it became mad.
I think you're probably right,
But you can't deny the fact that he did change rugby, and I think largely for the better. I think he did drag it, England rugby anyway. I mean, England were a fucking laughing stock for years. And even in the early 90s, it was still patchy. You know,
he dragged England into a real professional environment, and everybody else followed suit.
He almost defined what professional rugby is, didn't he?
In a way, yeah,
for better
he
or for worse,
I mean,
really.
And I don't think we should understate what an important impact that had on the game. However, he did also write an autobiography called "Winning" with an exclamation point in 2004. So,
did he say it's 25% technique and 75% attitude? Is that all it was?
Yeah. That's just two. It's just a replication of that for 400 pages,
seven times on a flip chart. Yeah. And then the P.S. Don't tell journalists you like buying cocaine. Should we do shit good and finish off this little rampant jaunt?
Yes, I suppose we should, shouldn't we? Yeah.
Gordon White gets in touch and says, "Shit is remembering I have to endure building Jerusalem." He says, "But good is remembering how shit it is." It isn't the best documentary. It is for about half an hour.
Brilliant.
The first half an hour is good. That's genuinely kind of enlightening. Rob Warlow gets to it, says, "Shit is Gary Barlow duetting with any other singer and crooning for our pleasure to keep our spirits up." The tossers.
Say Gary Barlow.
You had me at Gary Barlow,
there.
Yeah. Ian Alexander says, "Shit is building Jerusalem. Sir Clove and his entirely self-aggrandizing middle management speak bullshit." He said, "But good, as I watched Living with Lions afterwards and it was great."
Yeah, why can't we watch that?
Yeah.
See if we can spot the exact moment that Lawrence sticks half a fucking Columbia up his nose.
Goes like that fucking meme of the bald fella chewing his own lips. Mike Pop gets into it. He says, "Good is NHS staff working every day to save our lives." Yes, 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 indeed. And shit is having to do without PPE. I really don't want to get into that.
You really shouldn't.
Ian Bradshaw says, "More for Josh Garner, but good is the pairing of shirts in the 2011 Amling Cup final BT replayed at the weekend. Like my nephews have been given a packet of blue Smarties after a week in self-isolations and let loose on the paint box."
It's that Stad shirt, isn't it?
It's that Magic Eye painting Stad shirt, and then the Harlequin shirt is
an absolute atrocity, that shirt.
Is a Quinn and a white with a diagonal half and half.
It's awful. It's
very
an absolute
bizarre.
Yeah, it's very of that period of shirt design, and not in a good way.
Samuel Grant says, "Good is building Jerusalem's makers clearly not being fans of Delalio."
Yeah.
He said shit. He said bad, actually, Samuel. Do you not want to swear on Twitter, but shit. He said shit. "Watching Tony Diprose lead out England. How far the game has come." Yes, it has.
What's Tony Diprose doing with himself these days?
Lovely hands, Tony Diprose. Lovely hands. Yeah. Absolute pace like a fucking broken traction engine, but lovely hands.
He's wearing a fairly recent Harlequins. I think he might be head coach of Harlequins women. Let's find out. He's apparently... he's head of sport at Canford School.
course.
As of January 2020.
Private schools can afford to pay a head of sport like 85 grand a year, can't they?
Yeah.
So I'm assuming that's a private school. It might not be. Well, it must be, because state schools don't have a head of sport, for a start.
Yeah, they really don't. They have a head of PE.
who also has to teach maths.
Camford School is a co-educational independent school for day and boarding pupils situated in 300 acres of parkland near to the market town of Wimborne Minster in Dorset. That
literally sounds like a parody of itself.
£12,686 per term.
Fucking hell.
Yeah. He was one of the runners-up for Public School of the Year in 2016 and then received the top award in the Tatler School Awards in 2019. Honestly, just reading this makes me want to go and storm something.
Imagine not paying that and how many good kitchens you could buy.
Yeah, imagine, you know all about that now.
I do, yeah. Anyway, so what else we got here? Steve gets in touch. He says, good, is Parker Scarlett's being converted into a hospital facility to help with the coronavirus?
It is.
And bad, is people asking for season ticket refunds? I mean, come on. I mean, the season was two-thirds done, you know.
And it's literally a fucking hospital now. Chill out.
He says, David McIntosh says, shit, is my ability to teach my kids anything at all? He says, all teachers should be paid £1 billion an hour and in a helicopter from now on. I mean, the thing is, we're all isolated, right? I mean, my kids are teenagers now, so they're just in their bedrooms on talking to their friends. The idea of being like this, not being a key worker and having to have like two fucking 4 and 2-year-olds at home or something. Oh, I can't even imagine.
No, I can't imagine either. Sorry, I've got distracted by the Camford School Wikipedia page because...
Who were the eggs?
In 1992, a lost Assyrian stone relief was found on the wall of the tuck shop.
Oh, one, they've got a tuck shop.
It had been brought back from the site of Nimrud in northern Mesopotamia by some fucking grave-robbing guy in the Victorian era. It's dated from 853 to 859 BC, and it was just on the wall of the fucking tuck shop.
Who are their old pupils? Are their alum, their old boys, whatever it is? Ooh. People who go to private school always call it my school or our school, don't they? Even years after they've left. People who go to our school are like this, you know.
Old Canfordians, you mean?
Yeah.
As they describe it on... I mean, there's nobody brilliant here. No. There's always Gollings.
Ben Gott, right. There's always academics and people like that. Usually.
Yeah, yeah. Oria Duba, the 2016 Strictly winner. I mean, it's a lot of business people and editors of the Daily Mail. The man who founded Free Pages. I mean, this is...
Nah, it's low rent, isn't it?
They clearly need...
It's not exactly fucking Benjamin Disraeli, is it?
Well, they clearly need... They're John Barnes, but not that one. they clearly just... This is why they need to pay Tony DePro's whatever the fuck they've paid him. To, you know, to start churning out some proper sporting legends. Ben Gollings is not enough.
What else have we got here, then? Bruce McConaughey gets in touch. Hi, Bruce. He says, good is getting a new job that you're really excited about. He said, however, shit is having to forego any kind of induction process and be flung straight into days of meetings to address the biggest crisis your industry has faced in living memory.
Suboptimal. Yeah.
Do you know what? It's true, this, right? We're facing a crisis we've never... It's unprecedented, right? People keep saying that because it is. And actually, people use that word without actually thinking what it means. It's unprecedented. So none of us have any fucking experience.
No idea what.
So we are trying to come up with solutions without any of the normal ways of coming up with solutions, like getting in a room and trying to fucking get it sorted. You're trying to do it as 13 disembodied voices.
Yeah, on a phone. You can't even get in a room.
It's
with
very, very tricky stuff.
It's very odd.
It's very tricky stuff.
Very odd indeed.
Ros Mather says, good is Nick Heath and Mr. Andrew Cotter for doing sports commentaries without sports.
Yes, Nick's kind of gone massively viral.
He has, he's got 120,000 followers now.
Christ on a bike.
Couldn't happen to a nicer fella. He said, also, Ross says also the passing nod to Q commentator where Nick interviews Andrew Cotter. Point of order, I interviewed Andrew Cotter before Nick Heath did. So actually, can you put, if you go and find a Rugby Life back there, you'll find me interviewing Andrew Cotter. He was a very nice bloke, and I just dropped him a DM and just said, can I interview you? He went, yeah.
I like it when it's that easy, yeah.
He says, People's Elbow says, good, is Phil Greening taking the Marines training very seriously in the documentary? And it's a clip of him jumping off a landing craft
with a fucking gun.
With a gun and pegging it, mental. Fuming, yeah. Keith says, I don't know what attitude he was in when he... Oh, sorry, wrong thing. Patricia says, good, is getting to rewatch Fiji versus Uruguay yesterday on the World Rugby live stream without having to get up at half five in the morning. And he said, she said, the early start made me, one, forget how good a game it was, and two, I obviously teared up at the end with Gaminara's interview. Oh, you see, in these tough times, we should all just take a moment to watch Gaminara's interview again, shouldn't we?
I mean, we can, but then they ruined it.
Yeah. They did, didn't they, by pissing at a restaurant or something, didn't they?
Yeah.
Joe Tarring gets into it. He says, good is finding out on last week's pod that this is unexpectedly right in your wheelhouse. And it's a clip of the Backstreet Boys singing I Want It That Way from their various isolation pods.
Some of them are taking it a lot more seriously than the others.
They are.
What's his face? Nick Carter is acting like he's in a real music video.
Yeah. It's a genuinely wonderful song. When I went to Alabama last year to see the love of my life, Jaden Isbell, in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, they had an after party. Mm-hmm. With a live band karaoke.
Nice.
And me and my mate went up and did I Want It That Way with a live band. It was belted.
Is there anything better than live karaoke? I mean, karaoke in general, it's great, isn't it?
Yeah.
But, you know.
I'll have nothing said against it. It's glorious. Yeah. Well, you'd imagine I'll have nothing said against it because I'm fucking up there four times a night. I piss everybody off. Who's going on now? Oh, fucking hell, it's this prick again. Dave Garrick says, good is the Ospreys pack in the 2012 Pro 12 final that was shown on S4C on Saturday.
Ugh, honestly,
here is that pack.
I love that.
Paul James, Richard Hibbard, Adam Jones, Alan Wynne-Jones, Ian Evans, Ryan Jones, Justin Tipperick, and Bierman.
Bierman's the fucking weak link in that chain, but...
But still, six of them went on Lions tours, Dave says.
Yeah.
One of those ones wasn't Bierman.
No, yeah. Bless him.
Having said that, Christian Dacey went on the Lions tour, Dave. It's forever devalued now. You should know that.
Yeah.
Reece Knott.
And who's Corey Hill? That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah. Reece Knott says, also good is how popular Nick Heath is in his live commentary. Yes. That's what we got here. 10 Ep says, good is I've got a Majestic Wine delivery slot tomorrow.
Do you have to get a delivery slot for Majestic Wine now? God.
Can't
it
go
really is.
Is it
time
essential?
Is really all rough.
Is it classed as essential?
I think it probably is for a lot of people, yeah.
Graham Love says, shit, is my mood at the prospect of life continuing like this for the next several months? You can't last, well, just imagine trying to run a podcast, Graham.
Yeah, honestly. We're on week two of what? No, is it week two or week three of no rugby?
Yeah, it's hard to know, isn't it?
Yeah.
Andy and Brum says, good was the documentary. Batshit Clive aside, it was really interesting, informative, and at times quite funny. Okay.
Christ.
So there you go. That's the shit good. Thank you, everybody, for letting
Indeed.
Us know. It's been an hour and a half. We started late for this because we had various things going on.
Yes.
And I'm you know, and this, I've been on conference calls all day, and this is another conference call in many ways.
Yeah,
albeit more
too.
Fun. But yeah, it's
I'm really excited to not be in this room with headphones on talking to someone, as much as I enjoy talking to you.
Yes,
Lee,
indeed.
It's kind
indeed
of, I enjoy the silence.
I hope that we're brightening up whatever problematic, you know, self-isolation you might be in, or non-problematic self-isolation.
Indeed.
Thank you for a couple of people who've dropped us a line to say that, you know, we're helping them get through it, which is, so we will keep going, but we won't keep going for now because we're done. And
indeed.
We'll speak to you all next week when it'll probably be, I don't know what we're going to do. Classic match again. I don't know.
Probably. Who knows? We'll freelance it.
See you all soon. Goodbye.
Take care, everybody. Bye.
The world of work has changed dramatically and organizations are evolving. A full or part-time MBA from UCD Smurfit School equips managers to react at pace and deliver change. Now is the time to transform your career and gain a new business network. Join our virtual MBA Experience Day on Saturday, November 20th. Register at smurfitschool.ie/events. UCD Michael Smurfit Graduate Business School. Developing impactful business leaders.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.